And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith. It's spring. From now on in, there'll be more daylight than night. And in 2006, the equinox marks the completion of 2 full years that the Wild Side News has been broadcasting the voice of the Earth to the people of the Earth. Quite frankly, it's been a wild ride. And today, we celebrate the past 2 years and kick off the next as we take the pulse of the planet from some regular contributors and good friends when your voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News. Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith. This is the 105th edition of the Wild Side News. It's our second anniversary show. We now enter year 3 of your Voice of the Earth and want to thank you for being one of our listeners. You know, it's amazing how things have changed in the last 2 years. 2004 was the year of the wilderness, marking the 40th anniversary of the signing of the Wilderness Act. And, of course, it was the year George Bush ran for his second term for President of the United States. Looking back, I remember commenting on how the environment was mentioned a total of only once during the presidential debates. Walden marked its 150th anniversary, and global warming did not make up even one segment of the shows. Pale Mill got a lot of people angry about the arrogance of power, and something changed. It's as if nature got really mad. Because 2005 hit with the tsunami that sent a shockwave around the world that nature was in charge here. And then the environmental community got swept away in its own storm of protest as to whether or not environmentalism was dead. After all, look what happened in the election. Weighing in on the debate were members of the Apollo Alliance, who were painting these outrageous claims that energy independence was something we should strive for. But not many people paid much attention. And then the egg was cracked when John Perkins revealed that much of the world's environmental and economic struggles were actually by design. After all, he had played the role in such a scenario as a real-life economic hitman. A stupid diver killed Blackie the sea bass and upset residents of San Diego. And the Taklat wolf pack effectively disappeared. The ivory-billed woodpecker miraculously reappeared after more than 40 years of being extinct, or so we thought. And then America began finalizing a series of legislative undertakings led by the President and his Congress to wrestle once and for all control of the environment from the environmentalists and back where it belonged, into the hands of the exploitationists. Roadless areas were challenged, parks were to be sold, ANWR was to be drilled, oil and gas leases began appearing by the thousands where once people lived peacefully. Meanwhile, scientists were admitting that animals actually had the capacity to think and feel. And then, Katrina. And the record suddenly jumped onto a new track. And then Rita. And then suddenly, someone noticed that the ice caps and glaciers were melting, and Arctic ice was disappearing, and that China was buying up a lot of oil around the world. And then, as the new year, this year, dawned, people noticed that the oceans were dying, and that global warming was about to change our world forever. It's been quite a journey, covering the emergence of this new awareness, talking with the wonderful guests whose voices have sounded steadily and clearly over the past 2 years. So today, on our second anniversary show, we're going to take a bold step forward and declare our endorsement for the upcoming election for president in 2008. This is an easy one. If you care about this earth, there really is only one sound choice.
And maybe this early endorsement will help launch a much-needed change in leadership. Following the news, I make my pick for 2008. Then in segments 2 and 3, you'll hear from some of the people who've made the Wild Side News such a source of great wisdom as I contact previous guests and get their take on what's on their minds now. There is definitely a theme. It, too, is a wake-up call. But if you're a regular listener, you already know what that is. And if you're new to the Wild Side News, you'll find out. So we kick off year 3 of your Voice of the Earth, following this look at the news. So first, the news. Cyclone Larry, the worst storm to hit Australia in 30 years, charged into Queensland's coast, taking out power, houses, and tourists. The Category 5 cyclone boasted winds of up to 174 miles per hour, taking roofs off houses, uprooting trees, and prompting Queensland's Premier Peter Beattie to declare the area a natural disaster zone. He went on to say, "This was the worst cyclone we've had for decades." Unusually severe weather continues to make the news. According to AccuWeather's forecasters, the 2006 hurricane season will be more active than normal and could bring a devastating storm to the U.S. Northeast. There are now indications that the Northeast will experience a hurricane larger and more powerful than anything that region has seen in a long time. That's the thoughts of Ken Reeves, senior meteorologist at AccuWeather.com. "The Northeast is staring down the barrel of a gun," said Joe Bastardi, AccuWeather's chief hurricane forecaster. The Republican-led push to open part of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil drilling is back, as the Senate included the provision in their $2.8 trillion budget bill. Led by New Mexico Senator Pete Domenici, the bill is expected to be introduced for legislation in mid-May. Politics played a role, as Democratic Senator Mary Landrieu cast the deciding vote in favor of the provision after being promised $2 billion per year for levee and coastal restoration projects. Landrieu, a Democrat from Louisiana, was hard hit by Hurricane Katrina. Many in the environmental community were shocked that politics could be manipulated to once again push for the oil rigs to show up in Anwar. Bridget Bardot, Paul McCartney, and Sea Shepherd Captain Paul Watson are all heading to Canada for the annual harp seal hunt, scheduled to begin in 3 days. They are heading up to lend their bodies to help stop the slaughter of 325,000 baby harp seals, Canada's Red Terror, which has become an annual battleground pitting seal hunters, government officials, and environmental activists. 250 scientists and researchers have signed their names to a letter protesting the federal government's proposal to delist the grizzly bear in the Yellowstone area from the endangered species list. The bears, numbering approximately 600 in Yellowstone, have been protected as a threatened species but are now being studied for reclassification as a recovered species. Scientists, pointing to the need for adequate populations to maintain genetic diversity and population health, contest the 600 figure and suggest that 2,000 to 3,000 bears are needed to maintain a healthy grizzly population. Monday marked the end of the comment period on the proposal, which affects bears in Yellowstone and Grand Teton National Parks and the surrounding forests in Wyoming, Idaho, and Montana. And finally, a UN report, Global Diversity Outlook 2, concludes that humans have provoked the most serious loss of diversity in animal species since the dinosaurs went extinct 65 million years ago. The report blames this decline on habitat change, overexploitation, the introduction of invasive alien species, nutrient loading, and climate change, and sees no real indications that these trends will abate anytime soon. We'll keep you posted here on the Wild Side News. And that's the news. A few reminders. 2008 is an election year, and we have the right and the responsibility to choose a new president. It's really no secret that George Bush spends a little too much time in his Oval Office and would perhaps be a better overall president if he got out a little more, mingled with the people, and spent more time taking long walks along some of America's great trails, perhaps a wilderness trail or some quality time in one of our national parks. 2008 will give him, finally, the rest he needs to sort things out. And it will also give us the great hope and opportunity to choose a new president, to change course, chart a new path, renew our visions and hopes with a fresh start, if we are wise. Or, of course, we could once again let ourselves be bamboozled by yet another tried-and-true red-blooded politician who will carry on the status quo, leading us farther along the path of exploring the wonders in the quest of new sources of oil and generating economic security for those heavily invested in exploitative industries that take from the earth without renewing and give to those who have the most. 2008 will be a test of democracy, the democracy that we shed our blood and the blood of others to promote in the name of a dying neoconic quest for security for the existing theocracy. Or, we the people may reach deep into the soul of our nation's great legacy to honor the wisdom entrusted to the people in a Declaration of Independence and its Bill of Rights. Democracy, America, the voice of the people, the voice of the earth. There is something real and significant about all this, if we take the time to think at all. It's a whole new world, and America is dying for leadership, or better yet, for a lack thereof. And over the past year, I've heard a voice, quite literally a voice, that speaks clearly and boldly and forcefully and wisely. And each time he speaks, I feel something real being said in a way I've wanted to hear. He's a warrior tested by fire, attacked and throttled, bullied and smeared, and ultimately vanquished in 2000, or more accurately, victorious but with a catch. The great 537 vote defeat of Al Gore as determined by one vote of our Supreme Court. He took the outcome like a man, and in his wisdom he has reflected as great men do, and he's grown in stature, in strength, and in statesmanship. And he speaks of a democracy of old that will serve the democracy of now, if we are up to it. And he speaks of the sense that something is going so terribly wrong in America today. And he speaks of the urgent need to grasp the reins of power as the people, so that we may again regain our way. Because now, more than ever, as global warming, mass extinction, the emergence of China and India, and a depleted oil future become the world of tomorrow, we either apply our greatness today or lose the blessings of a true democracy in the world forever. And it is because Al Gore speaks so clearly to me, and because he talks as a leader must at times like this, that I commit my efforts to Al Gore for president in 2008. I'm not waiting. We can't wait. I don't expect many people to at this time understand my stance, but I ask in the days and years ahead that when Al Gore speaks, you take the time to listen. When we return, we hear what some of our guests from the last 2 years are saying about our world today on the second anniversary of Your Voice of the Earth here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith.
2 years of Nature Talk Radio. A lot has changed in the last 2 years because a lot has happened. And it's all documented in the Wildside News archives. Today, we visit with some voices from the past to see what they are voicing today when Your Voice of the Earth returns here on the Wildside News. Welcome to our second anniversary show. Over the last 2 years, the Wild Side News has talked to over 275 guests on topics as diverse as frog behavior, trails, national parks, the death of environmentalism, animal intelligence, and so much more. And we look forward to continuing into year 3. A lot has happened in these last 2 years. Personally, I've watched an awareness of the role of nature and the environment in our lives move from a secondary concern to, well, let's find out what's on people's minds. In the next 2 segments, you'll be hearing from some previous guests to see what they are thinking about today. In this segment, we hear from Ron Miles, naturalist from Minnesota, Peter Larson, who was uncovering a T-Rex known as Y-Rex, Dennis Hayes, who is generally recognized as one of the founders of Earth Day, and Jim DePeso, spokesman for Republicans for the Environment. So we start our conversation with Ron Miles, who recently retired as a naturalist from the Minnesota State Park System. Ron is always probing deeply into the mystery and crafts his journey in words well chosen.
Frankly, I just finished reading 1491. Well, Charles Mann has, it's a pretty, hot seller, if you will, at the moment, and it's a changing paradigm look at the Western Hemisphere based on archaeological macro evidence, you know, that only with today's technology can be put together into enough of a perspective and profile that the degree to which Western environments were cultural instead of natural is rather overwhelming by the evidence, and at least that's what this big compendium does. I'm not saying that it's a monster monograph. It's a sampling, and it's popularized, but it's a very, very intriguing sort of thing.
What does that mean, cultural instead of natural?
Well, it means that the reason that the biology is as it is, or was even when Columbus came, was that it had been manipulated by humans for dramatically for long, long periods of time, and with irrigation, with fire, and the, you know, the evidence is definitely there. I mean, of course, the specter of disease has played monster games at many times in the past, and a lot of things that have happened on our continent were artifacts of Europeans and of course what they did, what they set in motion either inadvertently or otherwise, as far as their subjecting changes and, you know, a lot of the things that we have rather blithely referred to as wilderness is, that's the other thing. And it's kind of a difficult thing to chew on a little bit right now, because in the wrong hands that could be used to weaken any sort of fabric of protection laws that we have. And, you know, in Republican hands, that's that's disaster. But
how is it that this concept of wilderness would be weakened? I'm trying to understand that better. I'm sure you have an answer.
I didn't say that it would. I said that it could, because of the way that people who wish to continue present economic exploitation trends into the future can easily fall back on the use of arguments that it wasn't wild to begin with. I think you'd enjoy reading it, and I'm still finishing it myself, but it's worth reading.
The last time we talked with Peter Larson, he was in the middle of unearthing a T-Rex from a secret location and documenting the entire process on a wonderful website. So, what's he been up to?
Well, I think the last time we talked, we were actually digging Y-Rex, the T-Rex, which is our eighth T-Rex specimen. And right now we're actually doing preparation on it. We found some pretty interesting things, including skin and the third finger for a T-Rex. Everybody probably remembers how T-Rex is only supposed to have two fingers. Well, it actually has, at least within the palm, a third digit. We have not found an actual finger that sits on that, but we found a bone that we didn't know for sure existed. We suspected it did, but we've got one for sure now.
How far along are you in reconstructing Y-Rex?
Well, we've gotten now about half of the skeleton, or close to half of the skeleton, clean. We'll be going back out again this summer in hopes of finding some more of that dinosaur. The final turtle count, if you remember, that one of our theories was it was killed by a stampede of turtles.
Yeah.
We were up to 22 turtles now.
Wow.
Of course, the stampede is a joke, but it's kind of fun.
Do you think perhaps that there was some sort of miring of the turtles in some sort of mud base or something like that? Or why so many?
Or
just a lake, maybe?
They're right on the edge of a lake, and I think that the turtle carcasses and the T-Rex carcasses were basically washed up on this edge of the lake. And by perhaps a storm, there's what we call clasts, or rip-up clasts, showing that there was really very active water. The water was really moving around and kind of ripping up the bottom. So there was maybe a storm that kind of pushed these things out to the leeward side of the lake and dumped them. So the actual cause of death has not yet been determined for Y-Rex. It may, like most dinosaurs, it's very difficult to see the cause of death. We can look at healed injuries and tell what happened during its life, but in most cases it's almost an impossibility to actually get the cause of death.
No, I actually haven't checked out your website in a while. Are you still doing updates on...
We do. We haven't updated for a while, but there are some more recent updates, including you'll see a photograph of the skin, and I think we have a photograph of the digits we have, or the bones we have for the hand, too, and found most of one arm, which is really cool. And some of the skull bones, I think, are maybe pictured up there, too. Anyway, we will be doing some more updates here probably within the next 30 days or so.
Do you have any new discoveries in line here to head out and to work on?
One of the things we're going to do this summer is we're, of course, going to be exploring for new sites, but we're also going to visit a couple of the T-Rex sites again, and which we've opened up again and let weather, getting a couple of feet above the bones or about 12 inches above where we think the bone layer begins. And using our maps that we've gone back to try to figure out where we might find more bones. And so we'll be revisiting a couple of our sites, including Stan, which is the second most complete one we've collected to date.
How long do you expect it's going to take before you fully assemble what you have there?
Y-Rex will have, it'll be probably another 2 years before we finish the work and mounting of the dinosaur.
Mm-hmm. Anything specifically that you've discovered that you didn't know when we talked before?
Well, the two things, the hand, we looked like we had a hand, some of the hand, but also we discovered most of the arm, which was not at all visible, and also the skin, which we had not seen at all. I had perhaps postulated that we might because of the type of preservation, and lo and behold, when we got the specimen home and started working on it, we started finding skin, and we've got about a dozen patches of it now.
Now, is that something that's rare?
The first T-Rex skin that's ever been found.
Oh, wow. Congratulations.
So that's pretty cool.
What's it look like? Give me a visual.
It looks kind of like a coarse leather, I shouldn't say coarse, but almost like the surface you see on leather. So it has the skin would look somewhat like an elephant skin, except finer textured.
Mm-hmm. Was there hair as well?
Well, interestingly enough, we have one thing that looks like a downy feather, very three-dimensional, and it may or may not be a feather, and even if it is a feather, we can't say for sure that it's T-Rex unless, and we're hoping, we're going to really, as we're cleaning these patches of skin, we're really looking, because if we can find some of them attached to the skin, we know that they were on T-Rex.
Wow, that would be totally different. One doesn't usually visualize T-Rex with feathers. It kind of changes the whole monster image.
Well, remember, T-Rex is more distantly related to Triceratops than it is to the hummingbird.
Interesting.
So it's closer related to a hummingbird. So we would finding feathers on it would be what we would actually, those of us who work on these guys, that's what we would expect.
That's good science. Well, listen, if people want to find out what you're doing these days, how can they do so?
Well, they can check us out at the WIREX site, which is unearthingtrex.com, or they can visit us at bhigr.com.
Which tells what
the whole our whole business is doing at the time, and lots of pictures of dinosaurs and some fun science stuff there. And
well, I tell you what, I enjoyed our conversation a year or something back very much. It was really a great adventure, and we'll keep in touch.
Okay, it's kind of fun. You have a very fun show.
Thank you so much, Peter.
You take care.
Mm-hmm. Bye. In 1 month, the world will be celebrating Earth Day. Dennis Hayes was there during the first Earth Day and is recognized as one of its founders. As we approach the 36th Earth Day, we hear what Dennis Hayes is thinking about.
Well, we've hit that point in the climate issue now where the majority of Americans, the vast majority, has now come to understand what the vast majority of relevant scientists has known for a long time, that it's real. And the real debate is increasingly moved on to where is the tipping point? Where is the point of no return? Where do you start getting into abrupt climate change of ways that cause Katrina-like things with greater regularity? And that gets to be a very scary kind of situation, particularly in a world where the largest emitter of greenhouse gases as a federal government is refusing to recognize the problem or to do anything meaningful about it. And it's caused me to begin to think in a way that may be even a little bit flaky about how we perceive things through the lenses of the world that surrounds us, and the world that surrounds us right now is a world of nation states. So climate has been approached by trying to get all sorts of nations, 141 of them, to ratify the Kyoto Protocol. But the nation state is a weird kind of construct that views China and the Vatican and the United States and the Central African Republic all as sort of the same things. It's as weird as the Electoral College in many ways. And we've learned now that when the federal government here won't do something, that doesn't mean that nothing can be done. And so one of the things that I'm deeply involved in right now is that the mayor of Seattle reached out to a bunch of other mayors and asked them to ratify the Kyoto Protocols on behalf of their citizens. We, at last count, had 115 mayors representing 43 million Americans in more than 30 states, bipartisan, who have done this. Stage one is pretty easy. You sign a piece of paper. It's a little bit political smoke and mirrors, and we're now getting to stage two. I mean, this week, the mayor of Seattle is announcing what he's going to be doing as a result of this citizens' commission that's been working for the last several months to design a program for him to actually move it. So in Seattle, to work on climate, because our electric utility is already climate neutral, it's a much more difficult task than for any other city in America. We're still going to be pushing electrical efficiency because it's an important thing to do, but we don't get a single Kyoto credit for saving electricity because it's carbon neutral. So we have to move on transportation, and we're moving on automobiles and on public transportation, on planes, on what ships do when they come into the Seattle docks, working on industry to see what we can do to clean up industrial energy. Tougher, tougher things with real political costs attached to it. And this stage is now one where the mayor is bellying up to the bar and being quite politically courageous on it. And it gives me hopes that even though the American government isn't doing things, around the world this stuff is going to be implemented not just by nations, but by nations, by provinces, by cities, by neighborhoods, by individuals. We all need to pull together, and I'm just delighted that in this country the cities are deciding to take this leadership role.
That is really the message that's come forth in about the last 2 years, is that you'll find a lot of schools, for example, that are beginning to say, you know, let's put in the solar. Let's just get it done. The state portfolio standards that are being set up are really taking the lead in making a difference. So it's very interesting to see how you're applying this in the Seattle area.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And in a lot of these schools, and colleges and universities for the most part, it's student pressure. Somebody's going to be building a new dormitory, and the students put on the pressure, and a rich alumnus comes in and says, hey, I'll pay the incremental cost to put the solar on the rooftops. It really is wonderful leadership. And now with renewable portfolio standards, a lot of them, the early days, they were done by public utility commissions. Last year, Colorado took it to the voters, and the voters approved it in a statewide initiative. And we also couldn't get it through the Public Utility Commission in Washington, so it's going to the voters in Washington State this year on an initiative. I mean, it's just people deciding we can't wait and moving to change companies as well. I mean, here's one of the really interesting things. The environmental movement for decades really worked in the traditional way that activist groups that have been fighting wars or fighting for civil rights or fighting for the environment have done. It was to lobby the federal government to put constraints around companies and put constraints around states. Today, the federal government is so resolutely anti-environmental in the executive, legislative, and judiciary branches that increasingly environmentalists are working with companies to put pressure on the government to do a decent job, and working similarly with states and cities to set good examples.
What's so interesting about that is the fact that we're all learning and progressing, and we're finding out that most of the people actually who run those companies are just like you and me. We're aware, we're conscious, we have families and kids and communities, and we understand that it's up to us, and we can actually make those differences. It's a whole new, I think there's a whole new thing that's beginning to happen here, and it's about time.
Yeah, well, the CEOs of several of the Fortune 500 companies, I'm sure, are the right age that they were out on that very first Earth Day planting trees somewhere.
Well, Dennis, I want to thank you for your thoughts. I know you're a very busy guy, and we're going to talk again down the road here, and any time that you want to share your thoughts, you contact me.
Great, Sydney.
If people want to find out more about the Bullitt Foundation and what you're doing, what's the best way to do so?
www.bullitt.org. But I'd really recommend for your audience, which is a broad audience, that particularly now in March with Earth Day coming up early in April, that they go to www.earthday.net and see how they can plug in and be doing something themselves in their own communities on April 22nd.
That's the next big moment in terms of this this movement that started quite a long time ago, and that you are very much a key player in initiating. Congratulations.
Well, thanks, Sydney.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Dennis. It's 2006, and it's an election year. The red state, blue state battles of 2004 will likely resurface. Jim DePeso is the spokesman for REP. We find out what's on Jim's mind in this election year.
I think the primary issue that is facing our country, and I think the realization is really sinking in, is that we have to do something about global warming. There's just simply no longer any credible argument that human activities are changing the climate, and that is a very risky thing to do, and it's time for our country to step up. And the longer we delay, the harder it's going to get our hands around the problem and, prevent, reduce the risks of some very serious consequences.
What has made you come to this this conclusion? As I totally agree with you that it's reached critical mass in many in the minds of many people around the world. Is there anything in particular that's brought you to this point?
Well, I think it's the fact that more scientists have come to the realization that climate change is not necessarily a gradual process, but that we could cross thresholds that could lead to some very dangerous changes in the behavior of the climate systems. The atmosphere, as past records have shown, or the climate, I should say, as past records have shown, is can be very twitchy, and changes can take place in the space of a few years. And it's like we are driving hard toward a cliff in the fog. We don't know where those thresholds are, where those tipping points are. We know they're there. And the more emissions that we put into the atmosphere, greenhouse gas emissions, the more chances that we're taking that we're going to cross one of those thresholds, and that could result in irreversible consequences.
Jim, you represent Republicans for Environmental Protection. What would you call an intelligent and informed Republican response to this situation?
I think that where too many of our Republican leaders have gone wrong on this issue is they have this very pessimistic outlook on how on the ability of our country's people and businesses to respond to a challenge. I think what they have overlooked many lessons from our past is that when our leaders really educate our citizens and say, this is what's going on, this is what we need to do about it. You know, we need everybody to help out and participate. People will rally around and say, yes, well, let's see what we can do, and we can pull miracles out of the hat. And this has been done many times in our country's history. Where our leaders today are falling short is they seem to be, you know, selling their own citizens short. They seem to be, overtly pessimistic about the ability of our country to respond to this challenge. And I think that you could almost say that hinges on lack of patriotism.
Hmm. You know, one of the interesting things is the fact that businesses, in many cases, as you're well aware, are definitely responding to this and seeing a two-sided advantage. One is that they can actually make a lot of money because we're talking, in many cases, about energy, which is big business, putting people back to work, using the creative spirit of American engineering and technology and inventiveness, and they see it kind of from a different perspective. Many people do.
Yeah, and I think, businesses are leading the way. More and more businesses are seeing that not only are there risks involved, it's up to risks involved with doing nothing, but there are opportunities with taking action. And in many cases, the politicians are at the end of the line when it comes to understanding what the risks are and understanding what opportunities are available, spin-off benefits if we make a serious crack at resolving this problem. So, again, I think the politicians are selling their constituents short. They are not remembering the lessons of our country's own history. And I think that is just a shameful behavior on their part.
Mm-hmm. Jim, if people want to find out what you're doing these days, what's the best way for them to do so?
Well, they should visit our website, www.rep.org.
Very good. Thanks, Jim.
Hey, thanks a lot, Sydney.
It wasn't more than a few months ago that energy independence was at the forefront of national news. And today, it seems global warming is hot. In just a moment, we return with updates from around the country for more of the guests who have made these last 2 years so very meaningful when the voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
With all the changes in the last 2 years and what people are thinking about, it makes you wonder what the big story will be at the end of year three. I guess we'll have to wait and find out. But you only have to wait a moment to find out what Fred Krueger, who focuses on nature and spirituality, and David Johns of the Wildlands Institute are pondering when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News. We continue with this special second anniversary show of the Wild Side News to get the pulse of the planet from people who work in the fields and forests of change. Fred Krueger has been pioneering the depths of spirit and nature as he takes people out to the wild places and opens the book of nature. It's always good to find out what's on Fred's mind.
Well, thank you, Sydney. We've got half a dozen programs right now that we've got cooking on the stove. We're continuing with our wilderness explorations to articulate the spiritual values of wilderness, opening the book of nature where we discern the lessons of the land. That's continuing. We've got a big program coming up in early May to go to Washington, D.C. and talk to legislators and speak with the administration. We expect a meeting at the White House. I think our biggest program is going to involve mounting a campaign to at least moderate some of the influences of climate change. We've got a four-part program that begins with education for religious groups, and then once they get a program of awareness of the implications of what will happen as the weather changes, we're going to be offering churches the chance to solarize their building. We're going to have a deal where they can get discounts on solar panels and a plan where they can recruit volunteers to do the installation. And we have an engineer and professional company that will oversee that. Then at the same time, we're going to start planting trees in the tropics. On average, every person contributes something between 15 and 20 tons of carbon dioxide every year. If they plant trees, they can begin to sequester or drain out of the atmosphere some of that carbon dioxide. Each tree over a span of about 30 years will sequester a ton and a half of CO2. And so we're going to ask individuals to zero out their carbon debt by planting at least a dozen trees a year, and we'll host facilities in Guatemala and in Belize where land will be set aside and there won't be any logging, there won't be any wood cutting or charcoal burning. We're going to grow trees, and it'll be part of wildlife habitat. And in this way, people can start to reduce their consumption, and then right behind that comes the fourth part of our climate program, and that's lifestyle change. We've got to change the way that we behave as a people so that we don't continue on this CO2 production treadmill. That means we're going to have to use solar, use wind, find a variety of alternatives to the energy that drives our lives and society. I think we have to remember that the whole of society is organized around energy. Everything that moves, whether it's food production, it's our transportation, it's our heating, and sometimes even the clothing that we wear is all driven by energy. And so let's start changing. And we have a responsibility, I believe, to embody those solutions in our own lives. If we don't do it in our own lives, how in the world are we going to expect industry or government to make the changes? Because they will respond to the behavior of the largest numbers of people. And so we're starting. And I hope that if any of your listeners are interested in some of the solutions that we're going to propose, they can contact us.
And how should they do that?
Well, our address is 887 Sebastopol Road in Santa Rosa, California, 95407. We're the Religious Campaign for Forest Conservation.
And how about a website?
Our website is creationethics.org, and you know, we were just hacked, and it was beaten into smithereens. We're reestablishing it right now.
You work a lot in the religious community.
And yeah, that's right.
An interesting thing that's happening, there's a change happening on the planet, and thank God that it's happening as well. Now the churches are getting involved in becoming aware of this particular issue. Give us a sense of what your feeling is about how that's growing.
Well, it's growing across the spectrum. Just on this issue of forestry, which is our emphasis, Roman Catholics now have a statement. And significantly, down in Mexico, the bishops issued a pastoral calling all people to be alert that forest issues is a life and death issue, and that caused the president down there, Vicente Fox, to declare their own national security emergency in that saving forests and clean water. Protestant churches, they are strong on seeing that forests have to be protected. In the synagogues, the Central Conference of American Rabbis has called for an end to all commercial logging on national forests and efforts to preserve old growth everywhere. And the same thing with evangelicals and the Orthodox churches as well. we're all beginning to link up on this issue, at least in terms of the thought leaders of religious groups. Now, here in California, we are pushing an initiative to end all cutting on private land, plots larger than 40 acres, of anything that's older than the state of California. This is called the Heritage Tree Initiative, and we are solidly supporting efforts for legislators to be educated to the importance of anything that's going to save old growth.
You know, it's interesting in talking with you and talking about the efforts to save forests and planting trees and getting involved in helping to sequester that CO2. You know, it occurred to me that what you're really talking about, particularly as it relates from a spiritual side, are sacred places. That what you're really helping to do is establish and maintain sacred places around the planet. That's
well,
just
I think
my
that's
take.
True, but we're seeing everything as having a sacred dimension, and so we see a goal of integrating our lives into the ecosystem of the planet, and that requires a value shift, because what we believe is really shown in how we find ourselves to be living. And if the way that we find ourselves to be living, and that involves consumerism and high-speed transportation and all those forces that are assaulting the life support systems of the planet, then we better change what we believe. And that's the test of what you believe, how you find yourself to be living.
We're talking with Fred Krueger. Fred, I want to thank you for being a regular, actually, on the Wild Side News. You always bring terrific ideas and content, and as well your work is making such a difference. My hat's off to you.
Thank you, Cindy.
We hear a lot these days about the demise of the wild creatures. Most of us can only hope that something can be done, and a few are making plans for reconnecting the broken fabric of life. David Johns puts the pieces together with his Wildlands Institute. How have the events of these last 2 years forged his current thoughts?
You know, there are two things that have been a lot on my mind of late. One is the fact that the declines that we've been talking about and describing in the natural world, the loss of species, the unraveling of ecosystems, are speeding up in a way that I think even in our worst thoughts we were hoping they would not. Even though the Earth's population the growth has slowed a bit, the growth in consumption has just been enormous and more than made up for the slowing in the population growth. And while no one can begrudge, you know, people in the developing world a better standard of living, the kinds of changes that are occurring in China, in India, and in some other parts of the world are just changing the equation so rapidly. And the kinds of things that are being done to protect biodiversity and protect ecosystems are, there's just, you know, it's a little bit around the edges. It's, you know, the fear is that it's just not going to be adequate, and like a big oil tanker, you know, you don't see the reef until you're about 5 miles away, and if it takes 10 miles to stop or turn the ship, you've got a serious problem. And I guess the other thing that has been certainly troubling me, although there's a lot of, you know, hopeful things on the horizon and people doing so much good work, is that the United States, the most, you know, powerful country on Earth with all of these resources, is undertaking policies that are just exactly the wrong policies. It's sort of like one of those bad science fiction movies from the 1950s where you know the people in the story are going to do just the wrong thing. They're going to go into the wrong room and they're going to cross the monster in just the wrong way. And of course, if they didn't do that, there'd be no story, right? In a grade B movie. But one hopes better from one's political leaders, but the overreaching, you know, the squandering of our wealth in the pursuit of oil, the squandering of chances to work cooperatively with other people in the world and to invest our resources in the kinds of things that might lead us closer to some kind of a society that's gentler with the earth, that learns to appreciate and respect that thing which makes our lives possible. It's not just that we're not doing the right things, it's that we're doing just the wrong things. And I fear that because people are so distracted by the war and by talk of terrorism, that they're just not seeing what is happening. So those are my two reflections on the last couple of years. For all of that, I have to say, people are certainly continuing to work very hard and very creatively to try to protect life on this planet. And I think as long as people continue to do that, there is hope. But we also have to get much, much better at it and find ways of reaching out to people that we have not been able to reach out to before. We can't do it on our own. We need lots of help. And we're not being very successful in getting that help, partly because I think we're still don't quite know how to talk to people about what we need to talk to them about.
It's an extremely difficult dialogue because it's uncharted territory. As I listen to what you're thinking, and I think about these things myself and try to address them, the planet has never had to face this type of issue and be able to have the capacity to talk about it in advance. And I think to a large extent, we don't even know what it is that we're supposed to be talking, as you say, when you think about China, you think about India, and the fact that they're apparently moving towards consumerist societies. What do we say to people like that from our wealth and our luxury?
Sure.
It's a dialogue I don't quite know how to talk about.
No, and of course, we can't say too much that anyone is going to listen to until we get our own consumption under control. And even talking to other Americans and Europeans and Australians, Japanese, it's very, very difficult to find the lever that helps make clear to people the individual choices they make day in, day out with larger policy kinds of choices and their willingness to get involved in the policy process. But we've created this huge machine that we don't know how to run. It's like once you build it and push the on button, we've lost sight of the switch, and
right.
And nobody's quite sure that, well, geez, even if we could find the switch, do we really want to we want to turn it off? Can we not just turn it down? Can't we have our cake and eat it too? Come on. That's part of the problem too,
yeah,
I think, is
yeah.
We've got a lot of hard decisions to make, and no one wants to, put their leadership on the line. I think, at least those that are already placed in leadership positions, by asking people to make those hard questions. And it's so easy for, when others of us raise those issues, just to be, ignored, or we just haven't found the right way of conveying those choices to people.
It seems, there's been a terrific amount of energy and investment and will and power directed towards creating, in essence, a one-world government of sorts, which seems to be the direction it's moving in. And quite honestly, there's another side and another vision, which is a brave new world as opposed to a one world. We need some really new, courageous thinking on a global scale here. And leadership, because, as you say, that ship isn't necessarily going to make that turn. I just don't think it is.
No, and I think that we're always sort of playing catch-up. When we talk about, the world becoming more integrated, that integration is, first of all, it's a very unequal integration, and it's being led by those with very, very narrow interests, large business firms, using the WTO treaty and other economic kinds of treaties, which are hard, hard law, and the entire direction is, growth. And when one thinks about material growth, what one is really talking about is the increased transformation of nature from its state as it evolved into products and commodities, and the rest of us are simply playing catch up, trying to find ways of ameliorating that or dealing with it. And we really need to get ahead of the curve and figure out new ways of not just thinking but acting in a way that gets us ahead of that curve and allows us to actually create something that we can steer.
It's interesting in talking to people, as I have been for this show, kind of summarizing where we're at right now. The change that I notice is that people have a leg in each camp, which is sort of interesting. I know that you've worked very much on very localized, large-scale, regional projects, but I find a lot of people who are really putting one foot in the global issues and saying we really need to address this, and at the same time trying to stay busy with their focused work in their own backyard. You're finding that to some extent being the case?
Oh, I think so. I mean, the model that the Wildlands Project developed of large-scale conservation planning and implementation is something that virtually all of the global conservation groups, World Wildlife Fund and many, many others talk about large-scale conservation and cross-border conservation and all of those kinds of things, and lots of regional groups all over the world talk in those terms as well, and work is moving ahead there, and very, very important work. But again, we're trying to set pieces of the earth aside when this great machine continues to claim more and more and more of the planet to again transform into commodities. So we're being essentially marginalized, and as important as I think direct protection is, that we have to focus on that and emphasize that. If we don't deal with these, you know, these larger issues as well, there was I believe it was at the World Parks Congress a couple of years ago, there were some conservationists, very highly placed international conservationists, talking about the need to, the only way protected areas would survive is that they were able to sort of pay for themselves and to show real concrete benefits for development, and that if they couldn't, the economies of the world would simply have to take those protected areas and use them for development. And one of the most wonderful conservationists in the world, Bittu Sehgal, who works in India and is a protector of the tigers, got up and responded, and he said, look, you have not been able to solve the problems of poverty by, claiming control of 90% of the earth, and now you're saying you want the last 5 or 10%. Well, you're not going to solve the problems with the last 5 or 10% if you couldn't solve it with the 90%, and you're not getting it. So,
you know, boy, I was waiting for you to say that. I didn't know that was coming. That's what I wanted to have someone say, and he said it. Wonderful. That's absolutely right on.
Yeah, Bittu is a wonderful, wonderful guy, and he really knows, he's working in an area, a part of the world where there's tremendous poverty, there's tremendous biodiversity, and he's right there on the front line, and he knows, I guess I can't say that word on the radio, but he knows that material which people sometimes hold forth, and one questions its value.
Yes.
So,
Dave Johns, we're going to talk again.
Okay.
And I always appreciate hearing from you and your thoughts, and I know that you're one who understands the importance of communication.
Okay. Well, thanks very much for calling.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Take care, Sydney.
Bye-bye. And so we begin year 3 of the Wild Side News. Talks of a difficult hurricane season, ongoing problems with the oceans, more forays into the minds of the wild creatures, the this way and the that way of our forests and wild places. We keep you informed each week, bringing you the intricacies of the wild places from the minds of the Earth's guardians. What will be the big story on our third anniversary? You'll just have to keep tuning in each Thursday or any time on the archives when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.